Thank you very much. It's a very it's a pleasure for me to come back to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. I spent a lot of time here as a student, and I learned as much attending the this speeches and seminars and the coffee and politics sessions they used to have here as I did in any class, I think. And it was a great experience for me. I've also been able to come back over the years as a journalist and cover various officials and politicians who have spoken here. It's a wonderful institution, and I mean, I love the place. I feel like I'm coming home whenever I come and speak here. And I appreciate the invitation from your professor, Tim Chambliss, to have me here. I'm going to speak for about 15, 20 minutes, and then I'm going to open it up for questions and answers the rest of the time. I'll just tell you a little bit about myself and what I do and why. What you'd call a hard news reporter, which I feel like I was born to be, looking back, for 20 years before I started writing a column. And when I started this column with Joanne Wells, it was called Raleigh and Wells in 1991, it took my editor about 6 months to talk me into it, because I had always seen myself as a reporter and carried those reporters' values. And those values included, you know, balanced reporting, objective reporting. In journalism school, you're always taught in that balanced reporting means that if you get the if you're writing a story and you've got one side making an accusation or a point that's controversial in your lead, you get the other person's side in the second paragraph. And that's what they teach you in journalism school, and that's what I grew up to believe. And so it was, frankly, a difficult transition for me to transition into column writing, where you throw that idea of balance really out the window, and what you do is you rely on your own instincts and your own understanding and your own research to actually come to a conclusion. It took me a while to, you know, get that down. I think for the first couple of years of the column that we wrote, I was still writing as a hard news reporter, because that's what I was trained to be. I've since embraced the idea that what I do as a columnist and actually throw in my own conclusions and sometimes determine in my column who's right and who's wrong. I've embraced that and come to believe that there is a definite role for that. The problem with don't get me wrong. I mean I'm a columnist and I'm just one part of the paper. Most of the paper is still written by hard news journalists who live by the principles that I just told you about. But why there is a definite role for what I do is too often you'll have two sides of an issue, and one side will give their side, and one side will give their side. And the reporter's trying to be objective and be fair and balanced and get both sides equally in the story, and you never do come you never come to a conclusion. You never do learn, you know, what's right or what's wrong. And one of the problems with balance is, what if one of the sides is lying to you? But you're still, you're taught to get that side in there. You need to do your own digging and your own research to figure out whether, an actual statement of conclusion should be made when you're writing. And that's what I've come to learn and embrace as a columnist. I cover the Utah legislature as a full-time reporter for many, many years. And now I cover them in a different way in my column, I think a lot of legislators preferred the way I used to cover them when I was one of those fair and balanced reporters I just talked about. But I like the role I have, and I see a definite place for it, because oftentimes I'll look and see what legislators say or what they do, and sometimes what they say doesn't match what they do, and I'm the guy who tries to point that out. One of the dirty little secrets that I have is some of my sources are some of the in highest levels of government you can think of, including the legislature. Some of my best sources are people who are legislators who I have criticized before more than once in my column. I think maybe their tactic is if they give me tips on somebody else, I'll be so busy with that I'll leave them alone. So it's an interesting relationship that I have as a columnist with lawmakers and with government officials. And it's a different relationship than what I had with them when I was a reporter. The relationship when I was a reporter was usually more comfortable, but not as intimate, if that makes any sense. Because now, one of the advantages I have in the column is that you don't have as a reporter, because the Tribune has a pretty hard rule that you don't use unnamed sources in your news stories. I get to break that rule. I oftentimes don't name my sources, and for that reason, I'm able to get find out a lot of things that reporters usually won't find out, because people are hesitant to talk to them because they don't want to be outed. The idea that in my role that I don't have to name sources, while some people might think that's unfair that anonymous sources get to say things that end up in my column about legislators or government officials or whoever, it's important that I be able to, that I have that, because when you start understanding the game up there at the Capitol, you understand how people oftentimes have to be anonymous, because if they're not, if people find out who's talking to the press or who's telling state secrets or whatever, there are many ways to punish those people, and I've seen it happen. So in state government, a lot of people are sort of up there kind of scared all the time and worried about their job. And I've spent a career protecting my sources, and it's paid off for me. And as a result, a lot of the people I write about now, they appreciate what I do, and oftentimes they'll always return my call. I can't think of a politician in Utah who won't return my call, because probably they want to find out what I'm writing about them. A lot of people would be surprised to know that I have a very good relationship with most of the government officials, including the legislature, we have kind of a different relationship privately than oftentimes it would seem publicly, because I've been criticized, by legislators publicly before who thought I wasn't fair to them or fair to the process. And those same legislators later on that day will have a very friendly conversation with me off the record on the phone. And that's just the way it works. The press today, I believe, has the relationship between the press and particularly the legislature, but politicians and government in general, is a lot worse than it used to be. The press had much better access when I covered the legislature full time in the 1980s. It was much easier to get access to legislators. I'm talking about reporters and that sort of thing. They're much more isolated now. They even have back stairwells, from the Capitol that they go down so they don't have to you know, if they don't want to meet with the press or the public, they don't have to. They have private stairwells that go down, and so you can't get to them. It didn't used to be that way. It used to be that you had a press table right on the floor of the House and the Senate, and now the press sits up in the gallery. And the press, I think, over the last few years has been under attack quite a bit from politicians in the political sector. The reason for that, I believe, is that we've become so divided politically in this country. When I was, a reporter back in the 70s and the 80s, in Utah, for example, the Democrats were center-left and the Republicans were center-right, and there really wasn't that much distance between them. And the press seemed to have a very accepted and welcome role in that whole process. Over the last several years, I think you've seen a stark, move to the extremes in both parties. With the Democrats, it started in the 70s, with McGovern and Roe versus Wade, and the Democrats started embracing a lot of social issues that kind of pushed them further and further to the left. And then in recent years, you've seen the Republican Party veer pretty dramatically to the right extreme. And so now there's such a division between the two, it's eroded any cooperation, and people sort of hunker down into their own ideological bunkers. And the press oftentimes is seen as now as an outsider, and you see with blogs and everything else, you see now a lot of politicians kind of forming their own media, and a lot of times they'll say that they need to do that to counter the biased press, which now we're labeled as being. Mainstream media now in many political circles is a dirty word. And you see, you see even national media organizations not being news oriented anymore, but being ideology oriented. And you got MSNBC and on the left, and Fox News on the right, for example. And I've always said that if one person spent all his time getting all his information from Fox News, and another person spent all his time and getting all his information from MSNBC, these two people would be living in completely different realities. They would have no understanding of how the other person thinks. And I find that a disturbing trend in the news. I've spoken now for, you got about an hour now left, and I promised your professor I'd give you as much time as possible to ask me questions. I think you're getting graded on this, so I want to give you a good chance to get an A. And I'd be happy to answer any questions. I understand you've been reading my column. Hopefully you've been paying attention to state and local government issues, and I think I can address just about anything you ask me. Yes, sir.
And if you'll go ahead and speak directly into the microphone and state your name if you do have a question, that would be wonderful. Thanks.
Hi, my name is Chase Hunsaker. You said earlier that sometimes someone will give you a lead on something just to get you off their back. Have you ever had a time where you gave a lead or you got a lead to somebody and that same person gave you a lead back to that other person and kind of go at it through you? Does that make sense?
Yeah, that happens all the time, actually. Everybody heard the question, right? I was kind of joking a little bit when I said that people would give me a lead to get me off their back. It never works. I always accept the leads, and then I check it out for myself. But that doesn't mean I'm going to not still look, scrutinize them as well. But what you said does occur frequently, actually. We'll just focus on the legislature, but I've had legislators get into a feud with each other through me. One legislator will tell me something. Now, when I call the other guy who, say, there's somebody who's being targeted with a criticism, and I call that person to get their response, I don't tell them who told me. I mean, I protect my sources. I've learned over the years that my most valuable asset is my sources. And the reason I feel like I've got a very strong network of sources is I protect those sources. And so I'll call somebody and with a, you know, say, well, this is, I've heard this, but I won't tell them who told me. And they understand that. I mean, I've been around long enough. I've been doing this column for 20 years, almost 21. And everybody understands how I operate now. And so they don't ask me usually who told me. But they will, oftentimes they'll know, you know, they'll say, oh, so-and-so told you that. And then they'll tell me something about so-and-so. And so, yeah, that does get into a pretty interesting little back and forth from time to time.
Hi, my name is Mary Meller. Can you comment on your relationship with the different lobbying groups on the Hill?
The lobbying groups have become the most you know, influential part of the whole process. You know, I mean, you've got actually there's a kind of a core group of very powerful lobbyists, you know, a lot of these guys are, you know, have gun will travel type lobbyists. You know, they don't represent. When I first started out as a journalist up at the legislature, most of the lobbyists actually represented a particular institution, Mountain Fuel, for example, or IHC, or, you know, large institutions had their own lobbyists, and those were the majority of the people who lobbied. Over the past several years, there's become more of a trend where lobbyists, they trade on their relationships with the legislature, with legislators, powerful legislators. The, you know, if you're in good with the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate, you can actually charge more money for your clients. But now you've got lobbyists who represent many clients, many different clients, and they're just, you know, they just put themselves out for hire. And like I say, they trade on their influence and their ability to have access to legislators. My relationship with most lobbyists, is good, is a relationship between a journalist and a source. And I get a great deal of my tips and information that I get that I then pursue come from lobbyists. And I understand what, I mean, I know exactly who's representing who and who their clients are. So when I get a tip from a lobbyist, I know that there's a motive there. There's a motivation. There's always a motivation with lobbyists. You know, they never give me tips, you know, for the good of you know, humankind. There's always a reason because they want, and I understand that. And as long as I understand it and they understand I understand that, you know, it works well. And then, of course, I'll check out their tips and you know, check opposing, you know, talk to opposing groups or whatever, and then come up with my own conclusion about what I want to write about that particular issue.
Hi, Paul. My name's Paul Greco.
Hi.
I want to be a journalist, too. You said that journalists rely on their own instincts and conclusions, and then you also said that there are two sides to an issue and that you never come to a conclusion. How do you stay unbiased as a journalist?
Yeah, I said columnists rely on their own conclusions, you know, and journalists but you're right. Journalists they try to be balanced and objective. I mean, of course, every story has to come to a conclusion, but the journalists try and keep their own. I mean, the news reporters try and keep their own opinion out of it. Where as a columnist, I put my opinion in it and have a conclusion. It's a good question about how do you stay balanced and how do you stay objective? Because you're right, there is not a journalist in the world who's not totally objective. I mean, who's totally objective? Because people aren't totally objective. I mean, people are subjective, and you're a product of your background and your what you've been taught and your environment, and so everybody's got biases. What you do you're taught in journalism school, really, to understand your bias. When you go into something, understand where your bias comes from and what you like about something, what you don't like, and then you put that on the shelf. You consciously put that on the shelf. And then you rely on the information that you're getting from sources or from what you observe or whatever to write your story. I mean, it's sort of like, you know, instructions to a jury, you know. I mean, you know, take your own personal bias out of it and just focus on the evidence. So that's what you're taught in journalism school, and that's what most journalists, I think, strive to do.
My name is Kyle Perkins. I'm a senior here at the U. And you made a comment about how the gap between the Republicans and the Democrats is widening. They're becoming more extreme over the last few decades. Many people in Utah have a fear that the Republicans are becoming so extreme and powerful that Utah is almost becoming a one-party system. Are people validated in that fear? And what are some events that caused that to happen, from your opinion?
It's a very good question, and absolutely people are validated in that fear. Although I would argue we have two parties in this state. We have a right-wing Republican Party and a moderate Republican Party, and that's where we've gotten. The Democrats, unfortunately, have become pretty irrelevant, and there are reasons for that. When I was growing up in the 50s and 60s, and then working as a journalist in the 70s, this state was very balanced between Democrats and Republicans. We had, for 20 years, from 1964 to 1984, we had a Democratic governor. We had a pretty balanced legislature up until the early 80s, and that's when it started really shifting. One of the reasons the Democrats started to decline in Utah, I think it started with Roe versus Wade, and the whole, the pro-choice, pro-life divide started getting pretty dramatic and pretty ugly in a lot of ways. And the Democrats, of course, they drifted to the pro-choice side because their natural, bend of the party was always, civil rights for everybody, equal rights, and everything else. But because of the dominant religion here, that became a very sensitive issue. And there are a lot of Mormon Democrats who had a hard time going with the national party in that direction because of their own religious beliefs, and so that started it. And then there were a whole bunch of other issues. The gay rights issue became very, very a big part of the political landscape, and the Democrats, of course, for the same reasons that I said for the choice issues, have been on the side of gay rights, which again has been a difficult thing for Mormon Democrats to stay with. A lot of them, not all of them, and so that was another divide. The Equal Rights Amendment became a big issue back in the late 70s. Created this social schism where a lot of previous Mormon Democrats had, couldn't quite go with the Democratic Party on that issue. There were all sorts of, doctrinal problems, I think, for them to go as far. And then there were a lot of suspicions about where the Equal Rights Amendment was going. That was another division. And then with all that, and that divide between, people with a dominant religion and a lot of these issues that brought the Democratic Party with them, then the Democrats became themselves in Utah became suspicious of Mormons, and the divide got even worse. And I blame the Democratic Party a lot for that. I can't tell you how many people I've talked to over the years who grew up as Democrats. I talked to a guy, if I mentioned his name, and I won't, but his name would be familiar to a lot of people. He told me that he grew up, when he grew up in his bedroom, he had two pictures in his bedroom of his two heroes. And they were Harry Truman, Democratic president from the late 40s and to the early 50s, and David O. McKay, the president of the LDS Church. And those were his two heroes. And there were a lot of people like him growing up in those days. And there came a point, and he loved the Democratic Party, and he loved the whole tradition of Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman, and he was a big John Kennedy fan. There came a point where he felt he was not welcome in the Democratic Party because they were suspicious of him because he was a Mormon. And it was a very difficult journey for him. And he ended up leaving the Democratic Party. And there are a lot of people like that. So there are a lot of reasons like that. And then, of course, there's always the issue of redistricting. Every 10 years, the legislatures go through the process of redrawing boundaries, for their legislative districts and their congressional districts. And I'll take Utah, but Utah's not isolated here. Every state will do it if they have a dominant party. But in Utah, as Utah's become more Republican, when they've redrawn the districts, they redraw the districts to make it more advantageous for Republicans to get elected. So they'll redraw districts to make it, it'll be a very Republican district. Well, when you do that and you don't have competition from the other party, the more extreme people in the party then, tend to get elected in those very, one-party districts. And I'm not just picking on Republicans here. The Democrats would do the same thing. Those are some factors as to why we become, so divided, and it seems like every election cycle, up until just recently, when I say recently, the last year or so, you've seen the Republican Party and the people who get elected to their conventions as delegates to their convention, you've seen them become more and more and more extreme. Now they're starting to be a pushback. And this last election cycle, there were a lot of freshman Republicans elected to the House, I think 17. A lot of them now they're starting to come back toward the center. And there was kind of a fight between the extreme, the Tea Party types and the more traditional, economic issue-oriented Republican. And as a result, you had this little movement for a while in the House called the Patrick Henry Caucus, and these were these really extreme right wing guys. Well, they're all gone now, all but one of them, and they've been replaced by more moderate Republicans. So I'm seeing that kind of move back a little bit.
Hi, my name is Enrique. I'm a health promotion major here at the U. I was wondering how the internet has helped your political column, if it's made it easier or harder to write your columns and get information.
Well, it's made it easier because it's so easy now to access information and access background. I mean, when you're talking about just me writing my column, where it used to be, I'd have to go down to the archives of the Tribune or the and look up old files, what we call it, the morgue, of people, or if I want to remember what they've done or get a history of something, or even go over to the library or go over to the historical society. Now I just get on Google, and I can find out something in 5 minutes that used to take me a couple of hours. So in that sense, it's made it a lot easier. As far as my column, well, a lot more people read my column now because of the internet. You know, I mean, a lot of people who've moved out of state or missionaries or people in the service or whatever, they read my column online. And more people read the Salt Lake Tribune now than ever in the history of the Tribune because of the internet. But most of them read us online. And that's the irony. You know, we have more people reading us than ever before, but we're struggling, you know, with circulation in the print edition of the paper as that dwindles and dwindles because more and more people are reading online. And that hurts us financially because it's still the advertising in the print edition that where we get most of the revenue. Did that answer your question? Okay. Yeah.
Hi. My name is John Christensen. I believe you said earlier, if I understood right, that the Salt Lake Tribune has sort of a rule about stating its sources. Does that mean if it gets an anonymous message to one of its reporters that the Salt Lake Tribune, in a regular article outside of a column, cannot use that information?
No, it doesn't mean that. It just means... they can check it out, and they do. I mean, they'll check it out, and maybe and then they'll find their own information. What I meant by that was, if you call up a reporter and you say, and you have exclusive information about something, and say a legislator or something, and you tell that reporter, generally, but I mean, there are exceptions that are made, but generally by rule, that reporter can't take your accusation and just run with it anonymously without quoting you. Now, I can, but I won't do it unless I'm convinced that what you told me is correct and I've done my own homework and my own research and checked with the person that you're talking about.
Hi, my name is Joseph Brinton. I have a question. So, can you comment on the relationship between the Deseret News and the Salt Lake Tribune? Because a lot of people see those as partisan, or as at least picking a side.
Mm-hmm.
Is that intentional, or is that just kind of a bias that people have placed on the two newspapers?
If there is a different bias between the two papers, it's not intentional. But we're very different from the Deseret News in our editorial pages. And, you know, in an editorial page, I mean, that's an opinion page. That's the opinion page, and that's where we – I mean, the Tribune just endorsed Barack Obama, which has gone – pardon me?
So the Denver Post.
Yeah, and the Denver Post, same owner. But Dean Singleton owns both papers, or is the publisher of both papers. And that pretty much went viral. But the Deseret News, you can see by their, you know, a lot of times their headlines and the way they their placement of stories and what particular stories they choose. I mean, there's a lot of suspicion that they're really backing Romney even on their news pages. There's a long history between the Tribune and the Deseret News, dating back to, the Deseret News, of course, was founded by the LDS Church back in the mid-19th century. And the Tribune was founded by excommunicated Mormons, back in 1871. And the two newspapers back in those days had these horrible wars, particularly on their editorial pages, and it wasn't just a religious divide because the Tribune, and then the Tribune was purchased by Senator Tom Kearns in 1901, and he was a big mining magnate, and he was a U.S. senator, and the feud continued, but it wasn't just a religious divide because back in those days the Mormons basically they were agriculture people, they were that was what most of them did. And the people who founded the Tribune were people who came into Park City, immigrants who and founded the mines. So there was an economic war, you know, fight. Because a lot of times the mining interests and the agriculture interests were came in conflict. And so, and then they used the two newspapers, you know, to fight that war. And so there was a lot of hatred and dissension between the two papers for many years. And then John Fitzpatrick, when he became the publisher of the Tribune when Senator Kearns died in 1918, he made a concerted effort to reach out to the church and try and have a amicable you know relationship, and it grew into deep friendships. And he had a great friendship with Heber J. Grant, who was the president of the LDS Church for many years, and that continued with Jack Galvin, who was John Fitzpatrick's successor, and he was great friends with David O. McKay. And they actually were able to do a lot of things together. Now, at the same time, the Tribune and the Deseret News had their separate newsrooms. And, you know, we were kind of the Irish Catholic newspaper, you know. I mean, that's who our owners were. And a lot of reporters, you know, had that background who tended to go to the Tribune, where the Deseret News, most of their staff were, you know, members of the LDS Church. So the Tribune and the Deseret News had two – their staffs – newsrooms had two very distinctive personalities, and that continues today. I've got a Tribune personality, but so there are differences that way. As far as covering the news, I think both papers try very hard to be objective and keep their opinions on the editorial pages, and I think both papers do a pretty good job of that.
Thank you for coming today, sir. My name is Ashley Jolin, and I'm an English and political science student. My question is whether you think it is incumbent upon a reporter to be a muckraker as opposed to publishing something dramatic about binders full of women or something like that.
Dramatic about what? I didn't hear that.
Just articles that will get a lot of attention, get a lot of readership, as opposed to something that's actually concrete, hard
information. I think it's a mistake for a reporter to go in to their job with that as their primary objective, to be a muckraker. If a reporter goes into a job, into his job or her job, with that being their primary objective, to dig up dirt or do something sensational, they're not gonna succeed. They're not gonna be good reporters. A good reporter, their primary objective is to basically, you know, write an accurate story, find out what the issues are, find out, you know, depending on what your beat is, you know, or just a lot of times you just cover, you know, whatever event that you're covering and do it in as honest and objective way possible. You know, I've said a lot of times, you know, when I was a reporter for many years and people had asked me, you know, what I've considered my role, my primary role, well, I always looked at it in terms of, like, you know, your parents are busy. They've got their jobs, they've got their lives that they have to. So they don't have time to go to the city council meeting or the school board meeting. So it's my job as a reporter to tell them what happened. You know, it's my job as a reporter to tell them what happened at the East High Highland High football game the night before, because they might not have had time to go. That's how I always viewed being a reporter. Now, in the course of that, if you do find something that's wrong, I mean, part of the job is keeping the government officials, the people who represent the public, keeping them honest and writing about what they do, and you want to be honest about what they do. A lot of times, if you write honestly about what they do, it's different than what they want people to know what they do. And when those things occur, then you have a responsibility to become a muckraker and expose those things. But if you go into it, with that being your primary objective, you're not going to be a good reporter, if that makes any sense.
Are there any other questions?
You got one back here.
What do you see as the maybe most contentious or most interesting topic for you coming up will be in the upcoming legislative for you to cover?
That's a good question. I don't, when you say topic for me, there are a lot of topics that will be contentious that I'll be involved in. There's the ongoing evolving liquor reform legislation that's on in constant motion at the legislature. There, I think we can see that there will be more bills coming up this session dealing with liquor reform. There's going to be some message bills. There will be some public lands bills again, like there have been over the last few years, where the legislature will want to make a statement about federal encroachment into Utah and giving the state back federal lands and that sort of thing, or giving Utah more autonomy on federal lands. That'll be another big issue. Education's going to be a big. There's going to be a lot of contentious stuff in education. There's a fairly significant group in the legislature, fueled by kind of the conservative element of the Republican Party, that are very suspicious of Common Core. I don't know if you know what that. Does everybody know what I mean when I say Common Core? That Utah. Is part of, it's 45 states have come up with their own standards for your academic standards in certain grades for math and language arts and then you got the some people in the right wing who think that's some kind of federal conspiracy to turn everybody into socialists or something and so you're going to see legislation dealing with that. You're going to see legislation trying to get Utah out of the Common Core. That's going to be a big fight, Republican versus Republican, by the way, because there's a big group of Republican business leaders now who have come out in favor of Common Core for stronger, because they believe it creates better standards and will result in better education. And they don't believe that it's some kind of a Obama-led federal conspiracy. And so you're going to see that fight play out in the Utah legislature. So you're going to see several things like that. And I'm going to be kind of in the – I don't cover any of those things as a reporter. But I'm going to be, involved on the periphery in all those little issues. And I'll be writing columns about them and that sort of thing.
Paul, I have a two-part question, maybe three parts, that deal with Utah State Legislature. One is the 45-day session, which is really about a 33-day session. Add a few days with interim during the year. Would the people of Utah benefit if the current legislative session were to be expanded, maybe from 45 days to 55, maybe to 60, add another 15 days or so, in order for them to do a more adequate or comprehensive job in considering legislation? For example, GRAMA, which Dan Jones said was never on the horizon when he was surveying polling issues that might come before the legislature, and then this was introduced very late in the session. And another question is, and you alluded to it, is why is it that public education, which constitutes about 60% of the budget, $13 billion. Why is UEA and public school teachers so demonized by members of the Utah State Legislature?
Okay. Good question, both. First of all, on the 45-day session, when I was covering the legislature back in the 80s, they had 60-day sessions. And then for a while, it'd be alternate. They'd have every other year, they'd have a budget session. And I can't remember, which was much shorter. And all they dealt with was the budget.
60 and 20.
Yeah, 60 and 20. I couldn't remember how long the budget session was. But, 20. And all they dealt with was the budget in that session. And then they dealt with everything else in the next session, which was 60 days. I don't believe anything would be any better if it was longer now than 45 days. Alluding to, you have so many, there's so many different things going on at the legislature. I mean, when I say things, I mean a lot of game playing, a lot of, a lot of personal, vindictiveness a lot of times, a little personal things between, a lot of partisanship, a lot of political games, and a lot of wasted time through all of that. Well, you alluded to grandma and how that just came out of nowhere. Well, I think that would have come out of nowhere no matter how many days you would have in the session. That came out of nowhere on purpose. I can tell you what happened with the way grandma came down. The Speaker of the House and had gotten together with members of the Legislative Research and General Counsel, the attorneys in that sort of staff office, legislative attorneys, and they decided that they they wanted to put more restrictions on how public access to government records and then they came up with this scenario, and they had a couple of examples. And that somehow, like if their email, if their text messages, example, were subject to grandma, then reporters would get to see all their intimate conversations with their wives and all that sort of thing, even though there are already protections in place in grandma to protect from that sort of thing. How that came down is that was just thrown out. They went into a private closed caucus in the House, and they brought John Fellows, the chief, the head of the Research and General Counsel, in, and then he gave this scenario and gave these stories about how they need to be protected from the big, bad, evil press who's always just out to get them, and they need to, clamp down on access to government records. And what they miscalculated, because they thought that the only people who would be upset about it was the press, but they found out that their whole constituency was upset about it, that all of a sudden they were not going to be able to find out what their government officials were doing, and that's why they hurried and repealed it, had a special session and repealed it right away. Once they got the flood of feedback from their constituencies and actually realize that that one single issue could actually, even though they were Republicans in a Republican state, could get them defeated. And so they hurried and did it. But the way that came down is, and I've talked to many members of the House, and that was the first year of a lot of these freshmen that I've told you about who are more moderate now. But they were in the Republican caucus, and they weren't going to let them out of that room until they all agreed to be unanimously back this anti-grandma bill. It was almost like Animal Farm or something, and then you got all the peer pressure. Here you are with your own Republican colleagues of the same party in the room with you, and you're asked point blank, are you going to be with us or against us? And so they all were under this, great pressure to go along. And so they left that caucus unanimous in voting for that bill. And then the same thing happened in the Senate. So you had unanimity among the Republicans who are super majorities in both houses to go out on the floor now in public. And they're already made the decision. They're going to vote as one for that bill. Now, there was one senator who bucked him, Republican senator, who wouldn't do it. And it came as a surprise to me. And if anybody knows this guy, it would come as a surprise to them. It was Chris Butters, known as one of the most conservative, right wing, extremist guys in the Senate. He bucked them because he believed in public access. I've actually admired the guy ever since for that, and he's a guy I've picked on quite a bit in my column. But anyway, so that's how that happened, and that would have happened no matter what the number of days in the session were. Now, remind me of your second part of your
public
question.
Education, UEA, why public school teachers are so demeaned by certain key legislators, and 60% of the Utah State budget is public ed. 97% of kids K through 12 attend public ed.
There is a growing sentiment in the Republican caucus of the legislature that's been, it's been increasing for years. A lot of it has to do with the Eagle Forum and the influence the Eagle Forum has with the Republicans in the legislature, and the Eagle Forum is. A lot of the people in the Eagle Forum are homeschool type people. They're the people among the people who pushed very hard for vouchers to give tax vouchers to people to put their kids in private schools so they get subsidized for their tuition in private schools. They're the people who pushed charter schools because they believe that. They're basically have always been kind of anti-government people, and so they've always believed that the private sector can do a better job in education as well. And their argument now is choice. But you've seen a growing, an emergence of that mentality in the legislature led by Senator Howard Stevenson, who is the president of the Utah Taxpayers Association, which is basically, their mission is to keep taxes down, mostly for business, and so keep government small. And those people have been getting a louder and louder voice at the legislature. And so teachers, schools are public institutions. Teachers are paid by taxes. And you've seen, as the Republican Party has moved further and further to the right, you've seen this growing disdain for anybody who works for the government or gets paid by taxpayer money. And so, in Utah, an easy target is the union and the UEA. You've seen them demonized because in order to change the rules and make it easier for the private sector to get into the business of education, and the Utah legislature has been moving in that direction in terms of giving coming up with programs to determine the progress of students, and there'll be computer programs, and they want to bid those out to private vendors, and you're seeing more and more private vendors now coming into different aspects of education and getting contracts made possible by legislation. And so, like I said, you've got this growing group in the legislature who just believes that the private sector can do it better, and they keep trying to move education more and more into the private sector. And in order to succeed in doing that and to succeed in their argument, they have to demonize teachers, demonize the Utah Education Association and kind of paint this picture of teachers being nothing but puppets of the evil union, and it's all part of winning the argument for these people. And that's a big fight at the legislature. And again, Republican versus Republican, because there's a good part of the Republican Party who doesn't think that way, and they want to strengthen public education. So that's going to be another fight you're going to see this session of the legislature.
Paul, do we have time? I have a real quick question. If that's
okay. Got plenty of time. Yeah, we go till 9:25.
20 more minutes.
Okay, good. I want to get back a little bit to journalism. I'd like to know, you know, what would be the future of independents and independent thinkers in this community? You know, I think City Weekly's done some of the best investigative journalism I've ever read. And yet, you know, they have trouble expanding and getting readership and things like that because they're constantly having to scrape for sponsorships and everything like that because, you know, they are sponsored independently. You know, Media One does more or less, I guess, control the what goes across the table at Salt Lake Tribune and Deseret News a little bit. I don't know because I'm not as involved as you are. But, you know, with Denver Post, it concerns me. I just got back from a deployment there and in Colorado and Denver Post endorsing Barack Obama and so on. What kind of opportunity do independent thinkers and independents have to counter that kind of thing in this community? That's my question.
Okay. You're right about Salt Lake City Weekly. They do some very good investigative stuff. They have, you know, they're a weekly newspaper, and that's what their focus is. Their focus is investigative reporting along with, you know, their entertainment stuff and everything else. But they every week they devote a big part of their paper to investigative reporting, and they devote a lot of pages. The reason that you don't see that much of that in the Tribune or the Deseret News is because we have to cover everything. We have to cover the daily news, and we're having a ever shrinking news hole, both papers, because advertising revenue is down, and the size of the paper is determined by advertising, and so as advertising shrinks, the paper shrinks. We still have to tell you what happened, you know, at your city council meeting the night before. We still have to tell you what happened at the legislative meetings the day before. We still have to tell you what happened in the sports arena locally. And our reporters, you know, I mean, the City Weekly has reporters who do nothing but investigative reporting. We don't have any reporter who does nothing but investigative reporting. They all have beats, and they all have daily, you know. So, yeah, it's difficult. When you say what can independent thinkers do, I'm not sure what you mean by that. But when you talk about Media One, Media One is a successor of the old Newspaper Agency Corporation, and the Newspaper Agency Corporation, and now Media One. Their role is they're a third company. You got the Tribune and the Deseret News, then they're a third independent company, and they contract with both newspapers to do the production, circulation, and advertising for both newspapers, and that was created. The NAC was created in the 1950s. Basically, it saved the Deseret News. The Deseret News was in very bad financial shape in the 1950s, but by being able to share the cost of production, advertising, and circulation, it cut down the cost of that for both papers because they share in those costs, and then they split the advertising revenue based on circulation, a ratio based on circulation. But they have nothing to do with each other's editorial departments. Like they have no influence with us, editorial, when I say they, I mean the Deseret News, and we have no influence with them editorially. Now you're starting to see relationships forming between the newspaper and a television station here, news-wise. The most glaring example is the Deseret News and KSL, which now share the same newsroom. And they share a lot of the same reporters. And you'll see the same story appear on KSL and then KSL.com and then in the Deseret News. And because they're both owned by the same owner, you know, the LDS Church. And so they become almost an entity together. The Tribune has a similar relationship, although much more limited and not nearly as close and tied with Channel 2. And we'll share some things with them through a kind of a contractual relationship.
That real quickly, I think you and me both remember when Kearns Corporation kind of controlled the journalism here and so on in the area, didn't we? You know, that was quite a liberal kind of organization as far as I'm concerned.
And I'm just wondering, does that still have some any influence as far as what editorial or what goes into the papers today as far as what Kearns has done in the past?
Do you mean the Kearns Tribune or, I mean, the corporation? You're talking about the Kearns Family Trust. Yeah. They actually had very little to do with the paper. All they did was cash checks. You know, they were members of the Board of Trustees. They were heirs of the Kearns Trust, but they had no influence in the paper. Our publisher was Jack Galvin for many years, and he, you know, he had a great deal of influence and exercised a great deal of influence on our editorial pages, and he had a lot of causes, and the Tribune pushed those causes hard on the editorial pages. He didn't interfere with what we did in the newsroom. Reporters were on their own, with their editors. We've always been independent.
You could hire and fire, I'm sure.
I can't think of one person who ever got fired for a story they did at the Salt Lake Tribune. And Mr. Galvin's causes weren't political. His causes were always to try and better, the community. You know, he's the one who pushed for the building of a bond to build the Salt Palace and things like that. That's what he was always pushing for.
That is all the time we have for questions at this moment. So we're going to go ahead and close out today's forum. If you could join me in thanking Paul Raleigh from the Salt Lake Tribune, that would be wonderful. Thank you.